Side two.
Not clear how far along we are, whether we even have reached the firing of Lee.
Well, let's go ahead with that.
All right, well, let me just be brief about it. The decision on Smoker not to give him tenure, I believe the firing of Austell, because it's possibly improper financial arrangements with the student, and also saying that he was instigating the students against the administration. Shortly thereafter, there were student demonstrations. There were articles in the newspaper about the campus, which we felt did not really portray the situation properly. We consulted about it. Finally, out of the blue, came an announcement that Lee had been fired and that Hamilton was now the acting executive officer. We were all stunned by that. Sidney Yalber, myself, Tom Irvine, had not been contacted by the administration at all in this matter. We felt we should have. Hamilton came down shortly thereafter to talk to us about it. We told him our view that that had been improper action, that the faculty were not all against Lee, because that was the impression he had, that all the faculty and the student body together were all opposed. And in fact, he thought he even would have our support, that Lee had been fired, that the firing of Lee was a good decision. And he clearly was greatly taken aback to learn that we were very upset by that action. We had a long discussion about how to proceed from there on. It was clear that the firing of Lee was an act that could not be reversed. He expressed regrets he hadn't consulted with the faculty, with us. We insisted on guarantees that he would consult with us in the future before taking actions as the chief executive officer on important matters. I particularly insisted that I could not continue on as dean in the graduate school unless I was consulted on all matters that had strong pertinence with regard to the graduate programs, the contemplated graduate program. He agreed that that, of course, would be done. And the upshot was that Gelber, Irvine, and myself, we agreed to continue to serve. It's only a short while thereafter that we learned, at least I learned, that he had fired Sidney as dean. I felt this had violated our understanding that he would consult with me and that I had no recourse but to resign, and I did write him a letter to that effect, that I was resigning because he hadn't consulted with me. I thought that was most unprofessional.
Had you talked to Alan? Had you gone up and talked to Alan before this? Or
I think that discussion with Alan I think that had happened well before that, because it must have happened before that, because we surely didn't go up. Sidney was along with us up in Albany. I don't remember whether Lee was with us, unfortunately, but Sidney surely was. So it the conversation in Albany with Alan must have happened before Sidney was fired. Whether it happened before Lee was fired, I just can't recall. Francis Bono would be the best person to ask about that. Or Sidney. So I resigned by letter to him, but I told him that was between himself and myself, and I didn't feel it was proper for me to explain to the faculty my disagreements with him as to his actions as president. I felt that was his job to be president, and, but I was resigning on the grounds of non-consultation. He came down to Oyster Bay shortly thereafter to explain to the faculty why he had fired Sidney. And to justify it, I vaguely recall, I was so upset at it that I'm not even sure I can recall just what he said. In retrospect, I would say that it was to bring harmony to the campus, that he felt it was clear that Sidney was a divisive force to restore some harmony, and to remove him. And he said it was unfortunate that I did not, that I felt I had to resign because I did not concur in the decision. At that point, I felt I had to make it clear exactly what had happened, and I got up and made a short speech that the reason I resigned is because he hadn't consulted me about the matter. Of course, in addition, I felt that it had been a move on his part. I would have told him so if he had asked me before the act. I think that ended with his announcement that Porter would be taking over the day-to-day operations. My resignation, I have no idea when this occurred. It clearly occurred before I stepped down. Because I put some deadline on it in my letter of resignation. You give it a little time to get a successor and so on. So I think it was technically, I think I officially stepped down at the end of the year, in December
61.
So I was really acting dean technically, I think, only from September to December, though I think the appointment was from July to December. Now, Dave Fox, I believe, was appointed the acting dean after I stepped down, and in fact, I think I was probably the only choice they could have made, because I think he's the only other faculty member who had some fresh experience. I'm not sure he had any graduate students. But anyway, he made a fine. And I was pleased at least that we had gotten the graduate program started and had agreed on ground rules. For writing proposals, collecting vita, both publications and teaching experience of the members, what the program would be, a list of courses that would be offered in the program.
And you said your proposal for graduate work was well received.
Yes, we sent up the chemistry one, and I don't know whether I got any word that it was well received or not, whether that was just after the fact that I learned from Dave Fox that everything went smoothly or not. I'm not sure the chemistry program was approved before I stepped down or not. I don't think. But that was the first one we sent out shortly, followed by the physics part. Well, we weren't happy. I must confess that our programs were the programs we would... that would make us very at ease, but we felt they were at least better than many programs being offered by respectable institutions at the time. And that was sufficient for us to get state approval. That was the premise. As long as it was better than well-recognized programs, then we felt that was adequate to ask the state to recognize that as such. And so that went along fine. Dave Fox pursued that. I retired to the physics department and worked on finishing touches for the physics program. I think that might be.
Were you surprised that Lee was fired?
Well, we were very upset that nobody in Albany was talking to us. Lee didn't seem to be able to get any response from Albany. I think he tried to talk to them and explain the situation. But clearly, we did... I think we had a strong suspicion to believe that actually we were told that somebody from central administration had come down to the area and had talked to some faculty members in Oyster Bay. But they didn't talk to us. It was the administration. We had heard that those rumors, so we were very upset about that. We were upset by the what we felt was the biased newspaper reporting, which we felt had been inspired by some dissident faculty. We suspected Martin or something.
You expected who?
The mathematician. Oh. Had something to do with that, but we were proud of that. I shouldn't say that. I know no basis for doing that. But it was clear that there were people, at least we felt there were people in Albany who, people on the campus who were talking to people at Albany, but the people in Albany refused to talk to us. So it was clear that the situation was unstable, and that may have been why we went up to Albany to talk to Alan about it, because we didn't get any satisfaction at Central Headquarters. So the firing of Lee, while it certainly came as a shock, was not a completely unexpected shock in view of the premonitions. Ominous premonitions that went before it.
I think Rockefeller thought well of Lee and was surprised that Hamilton had...
I wouldn't be surprised. Lee had an incredibly fine background. But he did have one failing. His previous position was dean of an engineering school. Now, engineering schools are fine. In some places, they are, as diverse as academia is. But in many institutions, they are a very closely knit group. And still, that was the situation in North Carolina. So he had no idea that faculty members could have such diverse views of how an institution should be, what its goals should be, and how it should be structured. It's clear we had not faced such a situation before. I'm not familiar with such a situation.
Well, we talked a little bit about the views of the central office of what the four university centers should be like.
Oh, right. Well, yes. We always had feelings that it would be a rocky road ahead because of basic political problems. facing the institution, the fact that the legislature could not be partial to one area of the state vis-a-vis other areas. So they were, in a sense, committed to these four institutions. This seemed to place a very large burden on the state. It was not clear they could live up to make four first-rate institutions. And secondly, the opposition of the private universities, which were very powerful in the state, Columbia, Cornell, NYU, to mention a few, Rochester, Syracuse, others. New York was blessed with many fine first-class private institutions of really first class. I mean, you know, at the top of the, you put some of them at the top of the list in the country. Columbia surely was one of the top three or four schools in the country at that time. And Cornell was not far behind. So it was clear that there would be strong institutional pressure against a development state. Competitors, especially four of them. We did feel we had advantages over the other three centers, that we were starting fresh, so we didn't have a large group of faculty with different expectations and abilities. And that we were near a major metropolitan area, which would make it easier for us to attract first-class faculty. And we were also not far from Brookhaven, which we had excellent relations with, and we hoped to build on that. So we had some strength. And the fact that Long Island itself was a large population region which didn't have a major institution. Now, of course, you can't have it both ways. Say you're part of metropolitan New York and then say you're not. It becomes a competition. So we did feel, and we did have, we felt we had Rockefeller's commitment. He clearly wanted to leave a monument that he had built, a major institution. And, of course, at that time, not long after World War II, with the GI Bill and all, there was a much more general sense of state commitment to higher education than there had been before. So in that sense, we felt we had things going for us. And I feel the firing of Lee was most unfortunate. It was probably inevitable in view of the fact that he was not aware of and did not make himself aware of the dissension at the institution. One can blame it on the fact that Albany sold him a bill of goods and to back it up and had their own private contacts with the institution, which they didn't make him aware of, and then let him know when they heard critical remarks in Hammerstein. Call him on the carpet and have it out with him,
but instead proceeded in secret to fire him.
But he knew there was trouble. We probably should have done more to figure out the extent of the trouble and how to stop it. The smoke of fire was said, I don't know whether you had that on the first tape. It was unfortunate because we could have, as I said before, one can easily tolerate 40 faculty members with different ideas of what the institution should be if the institution is going to grow to several hundred. in a few years. I think it's a small price to pay, and
these people can still do very important,
useful things for the institution, even though they may not be
a center
of activities. So that was a bad mistake. And I do regret I participated in that. I gave approval for that. But that, my only excuse is Sydney was running the show, and I was only concerned about excellence. But I should have
won.
We also have the kind of context within which Stonebrook was growing up. A central administration that did not have within it people with experience.
That was very frustrating.
Yeah.
That there were nobody we could talk to in the central administration we felt had the same background and views of what a major institution should be like that we all had. That we felt, I shouldn't say we all had, because we all didn't have that view, but at least what the administration had and what we felt was our mandate as laid down in the Hill Report. To become. We felt the people in central administration did not have the background, did not appreciate what goes on at a first-class university and what is necessary at a first-class university. I shouldn't say first-class university because there are many kinds of first-class universities, but a first-class large state university, which is a beast of its own kind.
Well, Harry Porter could not see beyond the fact that they had made.
They made a tremendous progress with the teachers' colleges. Unquestionably,
there was no national view. Johnny came in with a national view.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Johnny was was my kind of man. I mean, he had the same vision of what a first-class institution should be. It was very easy. We had a very simple rule. I had a very simple rule. In those days, they don't do it anymore, but they used to put out these five-year reviews of institutions, and they would rate them. And you get a ranking of what the faculty countrywide thought about which were the best institutions in which areas. And they rated every university in each discipline. First, second, third. It's unfortunate they stopped that because the schools rated low and lagging. But that was marvelous. I just looked at that, picked out what were the schools that were rated most highly by the faculty, you should know. Well, this is the kind of faculty countrywide, it's not the faculty of the institution themselves, which always have a biased view of how they're doing. And try to emulate the ones that were ranked the highest. That was our goal. And we wanted to be one of those. In some respects, it's amazing that we've accomplished as much as we have. In some areas, we already are at the top 20, let's be conservative, say the top 20. But it's unfortunate that
the last two governors,
economic thing, or whatever the reasons are, the attitude of the legislatures, the governors, or the economics of the situation, the school has essentially stopped growing in the last 5 years. Physics finally made it to the top 20. Music surely in the top dozen, I would say. Some of the biological areas are surely very good, or were until recently.
were until recently. And English was very good, but then probably not as good as it was.
Psychology moved up to the top, but unfortunately, you know, that's a matter of leadership to a large extent.
Leadership where?
Well, in the early days, in the first 15 years, I would say, it was department chairman, almost completely. And that's why physics, psychology, prospered. Alec Bond and Harry
Kalish
were energetic people, knew what top quality was, went out aggressively to get it. Went up to Albany, and fought the battles there, and it was very easy for them to impress the people. Because as you say, they didn't know what it was. So if you had a good aggressive chairman, he could go up to Albany and get whatever he wanted. And Kalish and Pond were able to do that. Mathematics was a disaster until they got the first class chairman, and Simon, who was an excellent mathematician and had the survey. You know.
Jim Simon.
He was just marvelous. He built that department in 5 years, you know. But just himself. Of course, he had to support the administration in a sense, but it was the chairman that did those things. After Toll came in, of course, Toll would try to do things, but you can't do anything if you don't have an aggressive chairman.
Yeah, that's right.
You just can't.
It's up to you to get the aggressive chairman.
I know, Toll worried and worried and worried about mathematics. And we in physics, of course, were very upset by a divisive mathematics. Oh, it was, what's the name? Bacchus, or something like that. Was it?
Yes.
Was the really scholarly person.
He was a chap from Oxford.
He was very good. He was very good.
But he was the one who wouldn't take it.
He wouldn't take it, yeah. I think it was a wise decision on his part. He would have been torn to pieces by what was going on in the mathematics.
Is he still here?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
He was here for quite a while.
I don't think so. Well, Simon came in.
Did a good job.
And now, who was responsible for bringing Simon in? I don't know.
They
never could get the math department to agree on anybody. Whenever one group in the math department would propose a good mathematician, the other group would automatically oppose us. They never could agree on any kind.
I'll find that out. I've got Jim.
Finally, they got Simon in, and it just. Overnight.
Yeah. Okay.
So, it's up to the departments. I think that's true in every university. Of course, the administration can do something by putting the money in the departments that it feels it has confidence in.
Right.
Here, it's very hard to do anything because Albany exerts too much control.
Yeah.
Well, so I don't know what the future is. My feeling is the university went far enough in its first 15 years, so no matter what happens in Albany, it will remain a respectable institution.
I think that's true. The health sciences...
the health sciences, you know, that's the first-rate people there, absolutely. International caliber people.
I think Pellegrino is proud of what he started.
Yeah, oh yes. I mean, he was an operator in his own way, but every successful builder has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, Johnny Toll was too. And we can regret that he didn't pay more attention to the way the campus looked
and the living conditions of the students, which is a serious problem.
But he felt the first thing was excellence. He did make important strides in that direction. So I think there's a basis.
I'm not gloomy about the future.
No. I'm glad to be out of it at this time, to be honest about it. It is a hard time for the university.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for coming in, Ernie.
Well, I'm sorry I don't have any concrete documents to give you.
Yes.
Resigned at that point. I felt he had violated what he had promised me, that he would consult. I don't have a copy of it, but it must be in the opening file.
Yeah.
And I told him that I can serve when he had promised consultation, and he had then taken action, which, even on the grounds of not consulting, I felt I had to resign, but which I felt was a mistaken act, that Sidney was a good man to the nature, and I'd be happy to tell him why. I thought so, if he would care to listen. So I resigned. So I was acting technically only from July to December. And he came down. I don't know whether it was in my letter of resignation. I told him that this was just between us. Of course, it's a private letter for myself to him, and I would not make it public unless he misrepresented the situation. My reasons for resigning. I just resigned, without any explanation to the faculty. He came down almost immediately thereafter to justify to the faculty his action. And he gave a long speech to the faculty saying that he had to restore harmony and all of that. And he felt the only way to do that
was... Was Porter with him?
Probably. Mm-hmm. But I was there for that. Now, Hamilton at that time was the official chief administrative officer. Oyster Bay.
Oyster Bay, right.
So he came down in that capacity to explain. He called a big faculty meeting to justify what he had done and hope for harm. And then he said, unfortunately, I disagreed with his action and had resigned. And of course, I was just living again. I mean, I didn't resign because I disagreed with him. I resigned because he hadn't consulted with me about it.
Yeah.
So I got up and made a short speech. About why I resigned. Yeah, promised consultation. And that was it. I was out of, I happily went back to my research at the time. Hamilton was again clearly very rattled by what had happened. Why he had done that, in my mind, is just inconceivable.
Who got to him?
Here he had been clearly rattled when he had fired Lee and realized that he hadn't heard the whole story. You would have thought he would have, again,
been listening to somebody.
Well, I have my suspicions as to who they were, but I don't think it would be appropriate. There were people on the faculty who were close to people in Albany.
Well, why don't you say who they were, if you think some of the people who were
Frank
close?
Frank Erich was clearly close to the people in Albany. I mean, he disliked Lee very much, and so what his motivations were, I have no idea. I assume it's just the way the direction which the institution was going. And of course we had screwed him in the Smoker case. I mean, he had hired Smoker, and And we had said no. Mm-hmm. One of the first acts, oh yes, when they fired Sidney, they reversed that action. Hamilton reversed the decision not to give smoking tank.
Well, they gave smoking tank.
I don't know whether they gave it to him at that time or not, but, well, they had to. I mean, legally, the deadline was upon us. So they gave him the pen. So I think it must have been Erg, because he would be the one most concerned about smoking. Now, of course, in hindsight, Smoker was a perfectly fine member of the faculty. Yeah. Actually, he turned out to be a very distinguished person in the faculty, yeah. So it's clear that was a bad mistake that the administration made. But again, that's in hindsight. At the time, I think they had to give a message to the faculty that research was important. Because there were clearly lots of people in the institution at that time who felt that they didn't have to do any research, that teaching was the all and everything. And we didn't feel that was perfect. We had to have a proper mix. So.
Okay, now let me turn this over.